You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Corporate governance has mirrored the decline in the country's fortunes over the last few years. Steinhoff, Tongaat and VBS certainly stand out in the rogues gallery. These organisations have all been accused of financial mismanagement and misstatement of information and illustrate how the corporate world has been facing numerous challenges in delivering a clean record when it comes to compliant financial statements, which investors and society can place reliance on. And central to these scandals has been the role of the audit function, both internal and external. The profession itself is facing a sort of existential crisis as we see liability claims increase on the one hand globally and the market demanding more accountability, insight and foresight on the other hand. In South Africa, observers have also raised their eyebrows at recent senior leadership appointments at the Institute of Internal Auditors of South Africa, as well as the Independent Regulatory Board of Auditors, IRBA, and the regulators for internal and external audit in the country, raising the question of who guards the guardians. Juvenal's question, qui custodiat ipsos custodes. The word audit means to survey or check. Ferreting after facts was once the auditor's main vocation, certifying information to assure investors that a company's numbers were true and fair. The reliance investors can place on this is increasingly thin, though, and while the profession stresses it's not a bloodhound, merely a watchdog, right now that many believe it to be a lapdog. Where does the audit process go wrong? And if investors can't rely on audited financials, what do we have? Well, this year, the Faculty of Economic and Management Sciences at the University of Pretoria celebrates its centenary, and UP Chancellor Professor Wiseman Nkotlu recently released his book detailing his time as chair of KPMG titled Enabler or Victim, KPMG, South Africa and State Capture. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Professor, along with renowned corporate governance expert Professor Mervyn King of the King Code fame, and who has also recently published a book on auditing with colleague Linda De Beer. It's also entitled The Auditor, Quo Vadis, and UP Professor in Auditing, Professor Karen Barrack. So welcome all. Professor Nkotlu, before we talk about your observations of the industry from the vantage point of Chairman of KPMG South Africa during that extremely turbulent period, as well as your recommendations to strengthen it, I'd just like to get your thoughts on the political context that enabled state capture. As they say, a fish rots from the head, and in your book you emphasise that the election of former President Zuma placed the country on a precipice. You say he was a person who consistently exhibited all the characteristics and tendencies that a national leader of a democratic country shouldn't possess. And inevitably, like-minded people drifted closer to him. The result was the institutionalization of an attractive, extractive political and economic circle of the elite that sought to enrich its members at the expense of the South African public. And it's these developments that created fertile ground for state capture and corruption. Ultimately, our saving grace was the Constitution. Now, this morning, we just had word from Deputy Chief Justice Raymond Zondo that we are all equal before the law. What did you make of the president walking out of the commission last week?
History shows that in newly independent countries, the tone that is set by the first president on ethics, as well as on a commitment to serve the public interest, as opposed to using state power to serve the interests of a single political party, is very important. And I make the point that President Mandela was aware of this responsibility, and he did set the right tone at the top. And President Mbeki strengthened commitment to good ethical leadership and serving the public interest. And then, of course, when President Zuma came, things changed. And then we ended up with a situation where the state had been repurposed to serve the interest of a faction. This is where we find ourselves. I believe that in a situation like that, the private sector has to now no longer depend on the leader of the state in terms of how it should conduct itself. It has to rely on its own resourcefulness and on its own commitment to doing the right thing. And of course, when now there's corruption in the country, the tendency sometimes is to try and find clever ways of continuing to search for opportunities in a corrupt environment, and in that process end up rationalizing or justifying why you continue to accept projects, even when in actual fact they're exposing your own brand to high risk. This is what happened in the case of KPMG to a large extent, and we've seen other cases where audit firms found themselves accepting mandates that they should have never accepted, but believing that they have risk management processes that can safeguard them from real damage of their reputation through association with corruption and state capture.
And Professor Nkutlu, you mentioned in the book that audit firms effectively have become all-purpose management consultancies, with all other revenue streams offered by services outside of audit, creating this internal conflict of interests. How might this conflict of auditing a client but also wanting to secure its business with the other services that these firms offer, the big four or the final four, as Professor King mentions in his book, how might this conflict be resolved?
Yes, you know, I've, of course, through the 2 years that I've been with KPMG, and in trying to understand why what happened at KPMG happened, I had to read a lot. You know, I refer to Richard Brooks on the Bean Counter and other authorities on this. I've become really convinced that audit firms should do much more to separate their audit business from the advisory business. There are recommendations in the United Kingdom that I think could actually move us in that direction. That is operational separation. In other words, for audit, have a separate board, separate CEO, and all the auditors only share in the profits of the audit business. In that way, you could actually make sure that the relationships that are developed with clients are really managed on the basis of ensuring independence of the auditor, a skepticism and courage to engage the executives where you have reason to believe that they are not conducting their business, you know, in an ethical manner. But when you combine the two businesses as chief executive, I believe that really clouds the attention to the focus on being skeptical and courageous in engaging the executives where you have reason to suspect that possibly the leadership is covering up bad performance after many years of success. Now suddenly the business is not performing well. They tend to rationalize, possibly not recognizing some expenses this year and you know, capitalizing them and things like that. Your courage to confront executives in that situation get really blunted if you are managing both businesses. So separation to me is the way to go. I just hope that that can be done without really having a significant negative impact on the ability of audit firms to attract and retain highly skilled people that they require to do their businesses.
That is indeed one of the major challenges amongst a few, if we were to talk about how that might be done in effect. Because Professor King, as you mentioned in your book, the big audit firms, the big four, need these balance sheets in order to acquire the artificial intelligence that big audit firms are going to need to compete in the future. In the context, though, of KPMG and other audit failures that we've seen, what are your views about audit firm liability?
Well, first of all, because of the unlimited liability of registered auditors and criminal sanctions now under the Auditors Profession Act, the audit profession is not attracting the best of accountancy professions. So one must remember, in a firm like KPMG, you've got accountants, you've got registered auditors, and you've got advisors, advisory work such as on tax, for example. I agree with Wiseman that there should be a separate company formed. So not only, and perhaps not even a Chinese wall, maybe even another building where the advisory firm is situated. But the advisors are needed in the profession for business. I also have found in practice that the auditing profession is no longer attracting the best minds because of criminal sanction and unlimited civil liability. And in my book, I point out that unfortunately the law in South Africa doesn't permit on liquidation, when a liquidator sues the auditors on the basis that they haven't dotted I's and crossed T's, in the oversight provision of making sure that the director's financial statements are in accordance with IFRS in this part of the world. It is, in my 50 years of experience in the corporate world, I've never seen one corporate failure that is due as a sole cause a failed audit. There's always a conglomeration of things, such as a COO, rogue COO, for example, in the famous Thoroughbred Breeders case in South Africa. So it's difficult when you've got a situation, and then there's an overlay of this expectation gap by society over auditors. I mean, to this day, they believe the auditors draw the financial statements, not merely an oversight provision, a watchdog provision. They believe the auditors are responsible for the financial statement. But the auditors are responsible under the Auditors Profession Act to report reportable irregularities, as it is termed in the Act. And this is when they see or believe on a reasonable basis that there is wrongdoing in a company. They have obliged to report it to the regulator, IRBA, and if they do not, they commit a criminal offence. Now, how, or there were, I think, it seems apparent that there were reportable irregularities in the audits being done by KPMG in regard to the Gupta family. And one must also remember that a swallow doesn't make a summer. You know, if you have one dishonest registered auditor in KPMG, the same as you have one dishonest director in a company, doesn't mean to say that the collective mind, that the whole of the company should be destroyed. So one has to be very careful that KPMG is actually a legal persona in itself. It's innocent because it's individuals that act properly, comply with the code of conduct set by IRBA, the internal KPMG code, which actually picked up that one registered auditor was not acting properly, and he wrongfully showed them some journal entries and invoices that the loan from VBS Bank to him had been repaid via, I believe, through a company of his wife, and then proceeded, I think, to borrow, in inverted commas, another 30 million rand. Well, you cannot stop neither a code, and the PFMA is the best evidence of it in state-owned entities. You cannot, by legislation, stop a dishonest mind. You cannot regulate dishonesty or competency.
We're talking about the audit and accounting profession, which is one of the most significant casualties over the last decade of state capture and corruption, and how the profession cleans house. It is self-regulated, it is a proud profession, it has attracted some of the best and brightest minds in the country. It's also a profession that has provided a pathway and a route to riches beyond the dreams of avarice in some cases. To become a CA seems to be the best route to become a CEO, for example. And so, Professor Barrick, what it also does is it attracts all manner of individuals across the ethical persuasion, those that want to serve the public and those that really just want to serve themselves. How does the profession and how do academics help instill and recalibrate this ethical culture inside the individuals that are going to enter into the profession in the years to come?
This is not an easy question because it's to embed ethical values in a person. We must also look at the skill sets of potential accounting graduates or auditing graduates. So it's a big responsibility for educators not only to educate people fit for business or relevant for the workplace, but they must also have the skill set and the ability to acquire professional skepticism whilst they're in practice and also to act ethically. So if we break down professional skepticism to its roots, it's basically judgment. So they must learn to exercise judgment. They must master critical thinking, problem solving. Ethics is not that easy. One, there's a debate in the academia, can you really teach somebody to be ethical or can you make them aware of being ethical? However, I believe there's a responsibility for educators to make sure that all auditing graduates have a deep, deep understanding that they will belong to a profession. And if you're a member of a profession, it brings about financial benefits and it brings about status, but it is equally, there's a responsibility, and that responsibility is to act in public interest. And that requires to demonstrate ethics, to act ethically, so independently, honestly, and with integrity, as well as to deliver quality work. Because that is the one thing that the profession cannot compromise on. Those two cornerstones. Ethics, which actually embedded in audit quality, but ethics as well as audit quality. I also want to return to that debate of big four companies and the separation of changing the consulting divisions with the audit firm divisions, with the auditing divisions. And it's not that I differ with the gentleman in our panel today, but I think one must look very carefully because it cannot be very simplistic. When auditors audit these complex clients, they need multidisciplinary teams. Some of the experts of those multidisciplinary teams are actually resided in the consulting divisions. Furthermore, auditors need to stay abreast of very many new developments, technology, etc., etc. And many of those developments occur within the consulting divisions, where they're close to practice, where they know what's going on. We've seen it with when business had emphasis on risk. We now see it with data analytics. Many of the data analytics experts are within the consulting divisions of it. And then furthermore, we mentioned the matter of attraction. The opportunity to have a career in one of the consulting divisions obviously also attractive for potential graduates. So that also stimulates them to be associated or to be employed by firms.
It is
so it's not simplistic to say, you know, you separate, and maybe that's why an operational separation is the way forward.
Professor Nkutlu, what we've also seen is that when there are failures, the tendency is to introduce new regulation. I wonder whether or not it isn't a question of rather strengthening the existing powers and teeth of the current regulators. And if you look at what's going on at Erber at the moment, there's a lot of discomfort around the new head of Erber, Janitha John, who was chair of the audit committee at Tongaat. How does one recalibrate the regulators here? What role do the regulators have to play to rather better enforce what we currently have, rather than going and over-regulating again?
Yes, you know, the regulators are very important. We need effective regulators that are properly capacitated. But I would start with remarks that Professor King made, and along the lines of saying that in this assurance, you know, responsibilities, we have a number of levels or players. You know, if the issue really should be to make sure that we reduce the number of corporate failures as a result of unethical conduct by companies and cases where the auditors fail. And then, of course, they must be considered by the regulators. So for me, it's very, very important that if the idea is to protect the public, let's regulate all the levels. We need to regulate more and have consequences for chief executives when they provide misleading information to the public or they hide significant information. Yes, and then, of course, the CFOs as well as audit committees. In South Africa, when we talk about this unlimited liability of auditors, and I believe that liability, to me, all the players, they must have liability responsibilities. They must carry portion of the responsibilities. So that's part of the thing that we must get right. Because in most cases, when a company failed, it's because the CEO or those real executives, they had better information. They had intentionally you know, acted unethically, and it caused that. But coming to your question really about the regulator, given the growth in the complexity of businesses, especially multinational businesses and the new technologies and so on, really governments and the public should call for better capacitated, you know, regulators in terms of really having the capacity to do investigations in highly complex, you know, areas. And that requires much better, more specialist inside ERBA, as well as a better budget to have that. And really, if they don't have that, these investigations are going to continue to take long. And of course, the private sector consultancy firms, including the audit firms, may have better capacity in terms of the intricacies in the areas in which they specialize. So there's a great need to do that and also elevate the status and stature of the regulator, you know, in the set of regulations. I know that is one of the Section 9 companies, but in terms of stature, that when we think of appointing a chief executive or appointing its board and all that and its powers, there should be more thinking should go into that, because the private sector, the big companies, have become very complex and they require much deeper understanding and better capacitated. So for me, it's we should look at this thing in this holistically. The auditor must take more responsibility for the quality of the audits and must be independent and encouraged to confront that. But in addition, the other layers must be disincentive to discourage them from conducting themselves unethically. And also in the end, it's only the auditor that carries the liability.
Professor King, we've got a couple of minutes left, and just come back to the title of your book, Quo Vadis, where to from here for the auditing profession? In a perfect world, what would you like to see happen to help restore the public trust and confidence in the audit profession?
First of all, may I just say I agree with Professor Barrack. My personal experience, having been chairman, director of companies and going through external audits, is the external auditor who spends some time going back to the advisory for a few years comes back is a more informed and better external auditor. And you will from time to time need the advice on a consultancy basis of those experts in the various things such as tax, for example, or whatever. So although they can operate separately, being an external auditor is stressful because you've got the civil and criminal sanction of the sort of Damocles hanging over one's head. And I've found those who just escape it for a few years and spend it in advisory actually come back or better and more informed, better auditors. Hence, my belief that from an educative point of view, we need as a multidisciplinary approach in teaching accountants today, because ESG issues, environmental, social and governance issues, even in the makeup of the market capitalization of company, is worth more on the market cap than those assets which are reflected as additives in a balance sheet according to financial reporting standards. That's what's happened around the world. And ESG funds in the capital markets of the world are growing faster than financial capital funds as we've known them for years. So how does one, it's a question of restoring trust with the public. And I think it's a question of educating the public as well. The public has this expectation gap, which is unrealistic. You cannot be a bloodhound. You cannot sniff this out, although you've got the duty of reportable irregularities. As soon as you think there's a wrongdoing, and it's very broadly defined in the APA, Auditors Profession Act, you have to report it to the regulator. And if you don't, you as the auditor commit an offence. So there is that avenue along where you can in effect become a sniffer of problems. But that's not your task. Your task is to make sure that the directors in drafting the annual financial statements have adhered to the standards required for drawing those financial statements And you've got to make sure, in complying with those standards, it represents a fair view of the financial position of the company at that time, at that particular time. And that's why I argue in my book, and I've argued publicly, that it's inequitable that we don't have an auditor judgment rule, the same as you have a business judgment rule for directors. That if you've got no financial interests, if, objectively speaking, you had all the facts at the time, and it seems at that time to have been a rational decision to give an unqualified audit opinion, but 4 years later, other facts come to people's attention, and it appears that you shouldn't have given an unqualified audit, you should have qualified certain aspects. Well, as long as that wasn't done intentionally by the auditor and wasn't done recklessly or negligently, then I think the auditor should escape liability. And that is the law in many countries, but unfortunately it's not the law in our country. The apportionment of blame and damages only applies to delictual situations such as you and I, Michael, collided at an uncontrolled intersection, you're doing 100 k's an hour, I'm doing 50 k's an hour. You'll have to pay 100% of my loss, and the court can order me to pay 50% of your loss. There should be the same in the breach of contract, because the appointment of the auditor is by way of contract. Unfortunately, the breach results in unlimited liability, and on liquidation, the auditor always seems to have the deepest pockets because they are compelled to carry insurance.
And I think on that point, Professor King, we have to leave it off because we have run out of time. It is worth noting that the cleanup at KPMG South Africa has seen it reinstated by ABSA, which was one of the first major banks to cut ties with KPMG on the back of state capture. So clearly giving the new management team time to rebuild that trust and recalibrate things. Many of the issues are still open for debate about how we reform and clean up the image, the tarnished image of auditing and accounting in South Africa. Thank you very much to today's panel, Chancellor Professor Wiseman Nkuhlu, Chancellor of UP, Professor Mervyn King, Corporate Governance Doyen, and Professor Karen Barak, Professor in Auditing at the University of Pretoria.